Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn. During the week, we talk apologetics, theology. I'll try to put up rebuttal videos or debate and dialogue videos, anything to help people better understand and explain our Catholic faith. But on Fridays, we talk about whatever I want to talk about. That's why we call it Free for All Friday. So today, what I want to talk about are the most valuable books on my bookshelf. What do I mean by that? So a few weeks ago, maybe it was last week, I don't know, it was a few weeks ago, I did an episode on a little-known book published back in 1989 called After the Ball. Go back and watch that episode if you haven't seen it yet. It's by Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen, After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 90s. It's a very prescient book. The strategies that were put forward in this book for the LGBT movement in the early 90s, because in the early 90s, the LGBT civil rights movement, it was really focused on kind of shock and awe tactics. Like, let's go do these outlandish pride parades with ridiculous costumes, and we're here, we're queer, get used to it. And Kirk and Madsen are saying, no, dial it down, make yourselves out to be the victims, turn people who have even a rational objection to LGBT ideology, just automatically label them bigots, shut down the conversation. So I did an episode on that book, because the arguments that were put forward, that's exactly what we're seeing today. It was very prophetic. And something that I also said about the book was that it's out of print. You can't really find the book anywhere. There's a few people who've got PDF copies floating around. Someone actually gifted me this copy because they knew I wanted my own copy of After the Ball for my research library. In fact, most of the books that I have for research are Kindle. They're ebooks. I try to download an offsite copy of them when I can. I really don't like using Kindle or Amazon Prime. I don't like the idea that I don't really own the content, because if I have just a Kindle library and all of the data is stored on a server somewhere in Amazon, I feel like I'm really just renting the material long term. That's basically what it says in the terms and agreements. I'm essentially renting it. And they could just take it away from me whenever they want to. So ideally, I would want a hard copy, a paperback copy. It's not like somebody, this is just going to poof and just disappear on me. But at the same time, I don't have a huge basement that can store 30,000 books like Dr. Scott Hahn does, which is awesome if you've ever had the chance to see or at least watch videos of Scott Hahn's library. So that's why, as a compromise, a lot of my books are electronic. But there's some books out there that you can't get electronic or print, really. They're out of print. The publisher doesn't print them anymore. Maybe the publisher doesn't exist anymore. And so there's just a few copies of the book floating around. After the Ball is one example of that. And so what I want to do today is talk about other examples. So when I say the most valuable books on my bookshelf, I'm not talking about like the most important books to me or my favorite books, you know, because obviously the most valuable books I have are those like the Bible, the Catechism, but you can get those in a wide variety of places. Rather, I mean monetarily their value. Now, there's some books that are in print, but they're academic books, so they're very expensive anyways. And that's always a bane in the academic industry. There'll be a book that I want on a specific topic, and it'll be from De Gruyter or other kinds of academic presses. And you try to go and get it, and it's like $100, $200 for an academic monograph. And it can get even more expensive than that for out-of-print books. So if you can find them, that is. Some of them, you can't even find them anywhere. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about a few examples of the very expensive out-of-print books that are in my library. Some of them, if I were to replace them, it would cost $400 or $500. Some of them, I'm not even sure I could replace them because I have not found any other copies online to be able to purchase. Now, sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes you'll have an out-of-print book that will be picked up by another publisher and it will go back into print. So to give you an example of this, this is the 1985 edition of the Old Testament Canon of the New Testament Church by Roger Beckwith. So Roger Beckwith, the Old Testament Canon of the New Testament Church. Basically, this is one of the go-to sources for Protestant apologists who try to attack the deuterocanonical books of scripture. Beckwith puts forward a very serious and vigorous argument for the Protestant canon of scripture against the deuterocanonical books of scripture. I mean, that's not his main outset. It's a scholarly work of research on the Old Testament canon. But if you read newer sources, like what I quote in my book, The Case for Catholicism, in the chapter on the deuterocanon, I show how Beckwith's scholarship is just out of date and is really more polemical than a genuine scholarly objectivity. But the point I make in citing Beckwith is that this book was out of print for a while. Like, I got this old copy off of, you know, used Amazon, great books, things like that. And then I think back in 2008, it was re-released by Wipf and Stock. So Wipf and Stock has like a million titles, and a lot of books that end up out of print, Wipf and Stock will collect them or get the author to sign the book over to them, and then they'll put it out there. Their publishing model is just publish a million books, even if each book only sells like 10 copies. If you publish like a million books, not necessarily a million, but they have a gigantic catalog. That's kind of what they focus on. Other presses are different. Like at Catholic Answers Press, for example, we usually only publish, I don't know, 5 or 6 books a year, but it's books that we think will do very well. And so we focus on those to get them to as many people as possible. But some of the books are still out of print. That's what I've seen from the examples that I'm going to share with you. The first one is a book by William Lane Craig. I think it was actually, this might be his doctoral, his PhD thesis. I'm not sure. It's called Assessing the New Testament Evidence for the Historicity of the Resurrection of Jesus. A wonderful scholarly title. He's got his old bio picture here on the back of it. And it's published by Edwin Mellon Press. It was published by Edwin Mellon Press. When I've gone online to try to get newer copies of it, maybe they sell it direct from Edwin Mellon, I'm not sure, but I've been to Amazon and other book retailers. I can't find it. Assessing the New Testament Evidence for the Historicity of the Resurrection of Jesus. It's an excellent book that goes through the early evidence for the resurrection and defending the New Testament evidence against skeptical objections. Very rigorous. If you can get your hands on it, it is certainly a must read. I don't agree with William Lane Craig on some issues, but I would say he is a formidable scholar, and especially his work on the resurrection, I think, has been very helpful in my development as an apologist. Bit of a side note also when it comes to out of print or getting books that are expensive. One of my favorite books when I was kind of growing up doing apologetics, this was published back in 2008, is The Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology. It's an anthology in the Blackwell series on essentially arguments for God and for Christianity. So it has one of the best essays on the Kalam cosmological argument in here by William Lane Craig and a colleague of his, James Sinclair. Robin Collins has an excellent essay in here on the fine-tuning argument. There's a great essay on the resurrection by Timothy and Lydia McGrew. The McGrews are really great at statistics and probability, and they put forward a cool argument in here. And I wanted this book bad when I was, you know, just graduated college, wanted to grow as an apologist. But it was only available in like a hardback form, and it cost like $150, and I just couldn't afford it. So I found a PDF floating around on the internet, and I downloaded it, and I kept it for myself and used that for my studies. But I felt bad. I felt like I was stealing. I mean, I basically was stealing. So my conscience got the better of me, and later down the line, I did buy a copy of the book to make up for that. I don't think it was a mortal sin or anything like that, but still, you know, they're selling the book. I shouldn't take a PDF if I'm going to be using it for a lot of purposes and not compensate them for all their work in creating this anthology. So it was never out of print, but it was like $150. I couldn't afford it. Now it's been re-released, I think, as paperback, so you can get it at an affordable price. I will say this, though, that if a book is out of print and I have found a PDF of that book, I personally, for me, my conscience tells me it's not sinful to download that PDF. You might feel differently, but for me, if I would treat it as the book has been abandoned by the author and the publisher. And so if you can't buy the book anywhere and it just exists kind of out there as a lost PDF, I don't think it's wrong to download it and to use it for personal research and reading purposes. But if the book is for sale, I would say that there are moral issues that are involved in choosing to download a PDF. This has probably happened to me. I'm sure there are free PDF copies of my books that are out there that are actually for sale. So you have to keep that in mind with copyright law, sin of theft, things like that. All right, let's go on to another book. And you notice a lot of these out of print books, they just have, you know, kind of your basic hardback, no cover on here, just on the spine. This is The Scholastic Analysis of Usury by John Noonan. This was published in the late 50s, and I would say that it is the definitive treatment of how scholastic philosophers understood the concept of usury, which is lending at interest. So when you look at the early church fathers, you can see a heavy pessimism towards lending money at any rate of interest whatsoever. But now the church teaches that usury, the sin of usury, is charging exorbitant interest rather than interest of any kind. This is something that a lot of people debate, and it gets very complicated and technical to understand how the medieval church understood when it was justified to ask for additional money on top of the money you have lended to someone and when it is not justified, intrinsic titles, extrinsic titles. We could do a whole episode just on usury lending. Maybe we will in the future. But a required reading to get into a lot of it is The Scholastic Analysis of Usury by John Noonan. When I've looked online, I think this book is like $300. It was actually, I think it was like his PhD or a thesis he submitted at Harvard, actually. And so very good research in this book. I'm very glad that I was able to snag a copy at an affordable price. And so that's one that I'm not sure how I'd replace it. If I did, it'd be very, very expensive. Another expensive one to replace would be a work by an excellent, I think he's French, French Dominican theologian, later made a cardinal, Yves Conger, Y-V-E-S-C-O-N-G-A-R, Yves Conger. The book is called Tradition and Traditions, The Historical Essay and Theological Essay. So Tradition and Traditions is Conger's 400-page explication about the nature of sacred tradition. Very good reading when you are dialoguing with Protestant apologists, because many of them will say, oh, tradition. Catholics just call anything tradition if they can't find it in Scripture. Tradition is just a made-up concept. It's not a well-thought-out concept. And that's not the case. Conger actually put a lot of work into this to put forward an articulate, coherent vision of what sacred tradition is. Now, this book, of course, is Tradition and Traditions, is out of print. I think I've seen some used copies for about $400. Very expensive. If you would like a slimmed down version of with similar ideas to it that is accessible by popular press, then I would recommend The Meaning of Tradition by Yves Conger, published by Ignatius Press. So Tradition and Traditions is Macmillan. I think it's out of print. The Meaning of Tradition by Yves Conger is available from Ignatius. I don't agree with everything Yves Conger says, but he was instrumental in drafting the documents of the Second Vatican Council. He was really focused on genuine ecumenism, of how we can find common ground with Protestants, with Eastern Orthodox. He wrote a book about Eastern Orthodoxy. I think it was called 900 Years Later, about the East-West Schism. So definitely a good resource that I'm happy to have, that I dive into when it comes to when people debate the finer points of sacred tradition. Here is the last out-of-print book. Then I have one other book that struck my eye I want to share with you. And that is a book. This one is definitely out-of-print. I don't even know where to find a copy of it, frankly. So I keep this one under lock and key. And that is a book by Mark Nowacki called The Kalam Cosmological Argument for God. It's part of a series, Studies in Analytic Philosophy. I have another one in this series by Nathan Oaklander, on the B theory of time, on a particular view of time. But this part of the series, I have not been able to find another copy of this book. There's very few book-length treatments of the Kalam cosmological argument, especially ones that are not written by William Lane Craig. Andrew Loke has a variant of it recently called a new cosmological argument. Andrew Loke, L-O-K-E. This one came out in the late 2000s, and it's very good. This is what Craig says about it. It is gratifying that the ancient Kalam cosmological argument, so long neglected by post-Kantian philosophy, is receiving renewed philosophical attention. Mark Nowacki not only surveys the current discussion of the argument, but contributes to it with a proposed analysis of crucial modal notions employed in the argument misunderstood by its critics. So Nowacki, not only the first part of the book was really cool about Nowacki's treatment of Kalam, is he has a great survey of all the objections for and against the Kalam argument. So it's a really great survey of the objections and replies. The second half of the book focuses on his unique contribution, talking about things, I'm not going to get into it too in depth, but it's a substance defense showing that an infinite past creates contradictions through something called temporal marks that can be seen in substances that create their temporal continuity throughout the past, and an infinite past would create contradictions. So I'm very grateful that I still have this, because I'm planning to do a deeper work on Christian theism in the future. And part of it will talk about Kalam or infinite past, and this will definitely factor into my research for it. So if you can find a copy anywhere and you're interested in really diving deep into the Kalam argument, you will not regret getting the Kalam Cosmological Argument for God by Mark Nowacki. There's a little bit of reviews back and forth, I think, on the secular web that review the book, but that's an excellent book there. I have one last one here. I don't think this book is out of print, but it's an interesting book. I just saw it and had to talk to you about it. It's called The Future of Marriage by David Blankenhorn. This, to me, is one of the best books arguing against same-sex marriage I have ever read, so-called same-sex marriage. Blankenhorn talks about the meaning of marriage, why marriage is fundamental across all societies. He does a great job refuting, what is her name? Stephanie Kuntz, I think is her name, who tries to say that marriage is really a relativistic notion. There is no universal concept of marriage across cultures. Blankenhorn does a good job rebutting that, talking about the importance of the conjugal view of marriage, that marriage is essentially a union of men, women, and any children that proceed from their union. So The Future of Marriage, super good book. What's interesting is Blankenhorn later said that he is no longer against so-called same-sex marriage. He says that he is in favor of legal same-sex marriage. But it's interesting, he says the reason is just so he can get along with people who identify as LGBT. He says he does not retract any of the arguments he made in this book, but he just wants to be able to, you know, get along with people. But so the arguments here, they still stand and fall on their own, and they're still very good. The Future of Marriage by David Blankenhorn. So I will review the books I went through here in case you want to ever look them up or your interest. These are my out-of-print books I love at the top of my bookshelf. This one, I mean, not out-of-print, Future of Marriage, still a great book on same-sex marriage. After the Ball by Kirk and Madsen on history of LGBT movement. Kalam Cosmological Argument for God by Nowacki. Tradition and Traditions by Yves Conger. Scholastic Analysis of Usury by Noonan. And Assessing the New Testament Evidence of the Resurrection of Jesus by William Lane Craig. So, hey, hope this is helpful for you. If you've got a very favorite out-of-print book that you keep in your library in a very safe place, would love to hear about it. Write it in the comments below. But hey, thank you guys so much, and I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.